let's get started because we have some guests on the line, and this is a Netflix documentary series that came to look. We do a segment every Friday night called Binge and Uncork. We've been suggesting shows that you should be binging on, and then one night John Tatey comes in. He's like, "Are you watching Wild Wild Country?" And I said, "No," and then he said, "You must," and so I did. I'm three episodes in. Joining us on the line are the directors McLean and Chapman Way, and John Tatey did introduce me to this, you guys, but I'm all in. I'm on the third episode, and oh my God, I can't. I have to rewind every. I keep rewinding, going, "I'm sorry, what happened?" There's a laboratory. They're carrying assault rifles.
Yeah,
okay,
just starting to heat up for you. Thanks for having us on. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for taking the time. John Tatey explained this to me, and I don't think any description really does it any justice. He said, "Have you heard of this cult that came into Oregon? They built a town that was ready for 10 to 15, 20,000. They were building these buildings," and I was like, "Yeah, whatever, John."
Well, I was just astonished that I didn't know about it, Patty.
Exactly.
And for people who don't know, it's a 6-episode series. It's on Netflix. It's about this Rajneesh commune that took over a small town in Oregon in the 80s. That description doesn't even start
yes.
to capture the madness of it. But it gets at so many salient issues. It gets at the sort of disorienting effect of a personality cult. It gets at the limits of our tolerance in America for religious and ethnic diversity. It gets at the disturbing consequences of Second Amendment taken
yes.
to its fullest extent, right?
Absolutely.
And I just could not believe I hadn't heard this story before. How did you guys come across it in the first place?
Yeah, so kind of the way that you described it in the beginning was kind of how it was first kind of pitched to us. We had wrapped up a documentary in 2014 called The Battered Bastards of Baseball. We were working really closely with a film archivist in Portland, Oregon, and he asked us what we were doing next, and we didn't really have too many firm plans. And then he kind of just laid out the story of Rajneesh Perm for us. It's this Indian guru and his followers. They buy this 64,000-acre ranch. They spend $100 million building this utopia. They take over this neighboring town. They bust in 5,000 homeless people. You know, they poison 751 people. And to be honest, we were kind of like questioning him more than the story because we just couldn't really believe that this had all happened. It was one of those things where we just felt like if it had happened, we would have known about it. But quickly kind of started Googling around and also digitizing all this footage he had. It was, we ended up with almost 300 hours of archival footage on this kind of like largely forgotten, but very fascinating story. And then, yeah, like you said, those themes, kind of testing tolerance for people that are coming into their neighborhoods and taking over. And, you know, this is ostensibly a peace-loving meditation group that arms themselves with AK-47s and there's voter residency requirement issues and land use issues and the difference between cult and religion. So we were just really fascinated to kind of tell this in like a long form, 6-part documentary series, and really excited that Netflix was able to that we were able to partner with them on it.
Well, and I'm stupefied every time the camera goes to people who were there at the time, every time you guys are interviewing either one of the followers or someone from the town. I mean, everyone is they're so reasonable, right? And you're listening to them the lawyer who was a part of the lawyer.
He's great.
Oh my God.
He was pretty solid.
And then, but then Sheila, I mean, I'm mesmerized by her. And then by the townspeople who are like, you know, and then these folks come in and everyone just seems reasonable. And I get every single side of it. Kinda.
Yeah.
Which makes
sense. Oddly, that was kind of our experience in making this was, you know, we would have like hours long discussions amongst ourselves and you know, it took us about 4 years to make, but, you know, especially during production and editing, you know, our own positions would evolve on this topic and kind of switch back and forth. But, you know, we would spend 5 days interviewing a former ranch member and, you know, you'd walk away kind of really buying into this idea that this was kind of government overreach and religious persecution of a minority group. And then we'd spend 5 days with kind of an antelopian rancher that had to live next to this kind of commune or cult. And they'd talk to you about how destructive this was in their lives. So I think that we are definitely interested in kind of the long form documentary format, exploring all those different perspectives.
And you know what, guys, that really comes through in the series because this is an amazing story. But as a critic, I've seen plenty of amazing stories that falter in the telling. And this is an amazing story, really well told. And I think it's because of what you were just talking about that you can tell that you guys did not come to this with all the answers. And you want us as viewers to go through that same journey. We don't get jerked around from side to side, but it's just a constantly evolving picture, and it's just such a pleasure to take it in and think about the consequences that you sort of lay out with what I would characterize as a gentle touch. There's not a lot of there's no narration, and there's not a lot of imposition of the directors on this series. Did you have that in mind going in, or is that an approach that evolved as you went?
Yeah, I think we're definitely interested in that going in. I think, you know, the way we consume media and news and politics today, you know, we just have such a like knee-jerk reaction to want to know, like, who's right, who's wrong, and, like, where do I fall on this issue? And, you know, this story was so complex when we pitched it to Netflix. We told them, like, look, this is not a traditional true crime narrative. It's not a whodunit. It's not based on who's guilty and what's the evidence. It's really like a thought experiment. It's an exploration into these two different communities, and we're going to dive deep and pull back, you know, the political and social layers of this era in American history. And lucky enough, you know, Netflix was really on board with us to do that. And so we were just really eager to have an audience like dive in and engage with these issues and do some real critical thinking before they end up with their opinions and how they feel about these issues.
Again, this is amazing. We're talking to filmmakers McLean and Chapman Way, who have brought to life this moment in American history that is astounding. And anyone who watches it, I just don't know how to explain it to you. We're not spoiling anything, but this is on Netflix. There are 6 episodes to this. And as you watch it for, I mean, it just seems so impossible. When you learned, obviously there's so much footage, right? Because the folks from this cult were taking, first of all, they were taking...
They taped everything, right?
Well, they were also taping the townspeople as a way to intimidate them, too. Like, we're watching you, which got very strange, but it was also an interesting sort of a revenge moment for them. But the escalation was the part where I kept going back and forth on. I had to rewind and watch again, and the next thing I know, there's like the creator of Nike in the middle of it. I'm like, what just happened? Do you have something that surprised you the most? And without spoiling it for people who obviously are going to get into this this documentary, what along the way surprised you the most? Chapman, I'll go with you first.
Yeah, sure. I think the most interesting thing I found is like how far like really thoughtful, intelligent people will go to defend their ideologies and defend their communities if they feel like they're under attack. And it's very easy to dismiss religious minority groups or cults, but oftentimes they do feel under an intense persecution from politically and socially. And so it was really interesting interviewing Ma Nanchila, who was the head of this entire movement, and listening to her kind of justification of what led her to these criminal actions. And I think it's really terrifying when you hear a really logical step-by-step approach to what leads someone into madness.
I agree. How about you, McLean?
Yeah, mine's maybe a little bit more specific. I just kind of have this very specific memory of interviewing the Deputy Attorney General of Oregon, and I won't spoil it too much, but there's this part where beavers get introduced to the story. suffice to say, things don't end up too well for these beavers, and it's kind of a part of this larger plan to poison more people. And it just didn't really come across in our research, and I think that he was probably saving it for the interview day. I don't know. But anyway, he leans into this story and just kind of rattles off very nonchalantly a very shocking thing that happened to these beavers. And Chaps, my brother, and he kind of shot the whole documentary, and I did most of the interviews. And it was kind of this moment where after the interview, we told the story, Chap and I just kind of looked at each other, and it was just eye contact. It was like no words, but we were both thinking the same thing. It was pretty much along the lines of like, what the F? Like, what the F did I just hear? That's kind of the censored version of what we were thinking.
It's one of a number of surreal moments in the course of the series.
Yeah. There
is all this footage of the commune, right? And they seem to have videotaped everything. How did you guys get access to these tapes? And how on earth did you sort through it all? It's such a treasure. I imagine that the production work of it must have been pretty daunting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually really rare because, you know, the story starts in 1981, right when kind of local news stations were switching from 16-millimeter film, where they would only, you know, film a couple of minutes of footage for each evening broadcast, to where they switched to U-matic tape in the early 80s. And so these local news stations would go out to this commune and just shoot hours and hours of tape because tape was so cheap. And even back then, a lot of news stations would film over their U-Matic tapes to save money on tape stock. But, you know, these news managers understood at the time that this was such like a significant American story that was unfolding that they decided to archive all these raw tapes that the cameraman had shot. So in a way, it's almost like an archival verite doc because we were working with this incredibly intimate, archive footage that was unedited and raw from that time period.
So this is footage that you got from news producers. I assume that a lot of it came from footage that had been shot by the Reichsnischis themselves.
Yeah, a lot of it came from the group. The guru was kind of like a real believer in using video technology to spread his message. So they would make these short documentaries and then ship them out to all their satellite communes around the world to help raise money, to help raise awareness for their religion. And so he was definitely a big believer in the power of media and that, you know, all good media coverage is good media coverage.
There's so many things that are mind-blowing in this and many what the F moments. But I thought there was also, I mean, there's so much logic on both sides, including the idea that there have been many communities across this country that have started as a religious movement, whether it's the Amish. I think that even talking about how the Catholics in Boston had control over, you know, politics and law enforcement.
Right. Yeah.
You talk about Salt Lake City or even just the state of Utah that continues to be.
That was such a fascinating monologue by the lawyer that you're talking about.
That was one of the most interesting components was this kind of church and state issue that pops up in episode 3. And, you know, the really complex thing about the separation of church and state is that it's, you know, it's a two-pronged law, which is on one hand, it's to prevent religions from controlling government. But on the flip side, it's also to prevent government intrusion on religious groups. And so listening to these two sides use the Constitution as both like a weapon and a shield for their own community survival was really fascinating to us. And both sides were so certain that they were on the right side of the Constitution.
And that was the thing. So that the Constitution to me goes all the way back to the very beginning because Sheila is like, you know, I know the United States. I know their Constitution. I know how we can make this work. Did you ever have a moment where you sat back and went, I wonder if people just hadn't messed with them, if they hadn't pushed back on this community, what that would have looked like in Oregon, if they would have gone to the extent that they did?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what's interesting is you're kind of asking yourself throughout this series, like if they had just been left alone, like would this group resorted to the tactics that they did? And, you know, my personal opinion is that they did not move to Oregon to poison 750 people and to try and assassinate, you know, the U.S. attorney of the District of Oregon. You know, these were kind of like the really tragic side effects of like this paranoia and pressure that was circulating within this religious community.
Yeah. John.
Guys, this is my million-dollar question, and I'm so excited that I get to ask you this. What? I'm watching the series, and the question I'm left with is, what the heck was it about this guy, Osho, that made him so magnetic to these people? I can see why they would be attracted to the way of life. I can see why they would be attracted to some of the ideas. But whenever we see Osho in action, and granted, he's silent for a large part of the story, he just seems like kind of a vain doofus to me. And Sheila is the one with the energy and the just incredible charisma. What do you think people saw in Osho? The lawyer in particular seems especially enamored with just being in his presence.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's a question that we ask ourselves constantly. And we would ask, you know, current and former members of this group to try to explain to us. And I think at a certain point, this was kind of, you know, when a lot of these people first joined this movement, it, you know, before Roshni's term, they went to Pune, India. And this was kind of at the very end of 1960s counterculturalism. I think that they had a deep kind of disillusionment with the direction of the country. It's not too different than I think some of the situations that people feel about where we are today.
Yeah.
But they were seekers. You know, that's what they identified as. That was a core part of their identity and who they believed. So there was kind of this Eastern migration of Westerners to India. And I think that Bhagwan was able to carve himself out as very different than other gurus who were preaching the rejection of desire and the rejection of wealth and food and sex. And Bhagwan said you can have it all and still become enlightened. And I think that was incredibly appealing and attractive to successful Westerners who got to keep the, you know, who didn't need to be be kind of ashamed of their wealth, but also got to feel like they were walking a path of enlightenment. And so, but I think what's interesting is as it did come to the ranch, what you said is spot on. Bhagwan takes this vow of silence. And so then when we would ask people, well, when he wasn't talking, what was the attraction? What was the appeal of this? And really, I think whether they admitted it openly or not, what they would talk about is just kind of like the power of community and family that they felt out there. I think a common theme among a lot of followers were these were people that didn't have the happiest of childhoods, or there was something, there was a void there, there was something missing. A lot of them grew up in highly religious households, whether they were strictly Catholics or Mormons or evangelical Christians, and then kind of broke away from that, but still kind of wanted devotion and faith in their life. So it was a lot of different answers, but I think that towards the ranch, I think why they became so committed to defending not just Bhagwan, but the community, was because they really felt like that had become their kind of eternal home.
I should let the listeners know that Osho and Bhagwan, this is the same person we're talking about.
Right.
They are. Sorry, names, yeah. I don't. I got it. Am I using them interchangeably? I used to get so frustrated.
No, I was.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry.
I've seen three episodes, and I'm still trying. I'm like, what, wait, which one's which? And I just know Sheila. Yeah. By the way, I don't know if you know who played Vern in Stand By Me, but he posted about this last night that for Halloween he wants to go to Goodwill and buy all the maroon and pink and purple clothing.
And I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, you have to check it out. So I tweeted at him. I'm like, you should call in tonight. And someone else posted they want to be Sheila for Halloween. But I think that this is the kind of attention and that you guys deserve. I mean, beyond that, such incredible filmmaking. Congratulations on this.
Yeah.
And I can't thank you enough for doing this and clearly putting in so much of every side of this. A moment in history that I just didn't know about. I was too young, but even I asked my mom and she does not really remember this. And clearly it was covered on national news. Go ahead.
Yeah, it kind of oddly stayed within Oregon, and that was definitely what kind of attracted us to telling the story. Mm. But it feels great to hear that. I mean, honestly, this was something that we spent the better part of 3 or 4 years working on, and the last 3 weeks have been amazing, kind of watching it kind of launch on Netflix and listening to people deeply engaged in the series. It honestly was not something we were expecting that much of, and so it's just been an absolute thrill for us.
That's great. You deserve it. It's a really special series. It's
yes.
Wild, Wild Country on Netflix, if you're listening
again,
out there.
Yes.
Check it out.
Wild, Wild Country. And I got to go back and see, what is it called? Battered Bastards? I don't know the other one. I love baseball. I've got to find this one, too. So
It's on Netflix. It was a Netflix doc in 2014. It's a fun one, too. It's Oregon-based, too. So
okay.
You're going to be an Oregon history buff pretty soon once you're done with our documentary.
Well, yeah, I'm going to be thirsty for something, so I look forward to that. Because you have that sort of letdown when you finish something that you really have gotten into, and so I'm glad that you've got other work out there for us to find. Where can people find out more about you in particular and the work that you're doing?
You know what? We don't really have kind of a place for that so much.
Good
we're
for
a little
you.
Bit.
They're just small, artists.
Yeah, we're a little bit of a small team, and my brother and I make our documentaries together. Chaff's wife Juliana is our producer, and we kind of tend to make these things a little bit just in our bedrooms. And then we've just been fortunate to always have kind of Netflix there for us to kind of launch these things out. We're working on some more documentary series, kind of as we speak. It's an exciting genre. We never expected it after features to jump right into series, but it's a big canvas, and it's, as a filmmaker, you're kind of thrilled with the amount of space you're given to play with stories in that.
Well, thank you for playing, because this is amazing. And again, Wild, Wild Country. John and I cannot recommend this more. And I know Michael has seen this. And again, it's incredible. And thank you. If you guys are coming through Chicago at all, we'd love to have you in studio.
Oh,
well,
that'd be a blast.
Please. Be well, you guys.
Sure.
Looking forward to all the other work that you have to come and what you've already done. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us on again, guys.
Oh, bye-bye. Our pleasure. Thank you again. That was McLean and Chapman Way. See their series, Wild Wild Country, playing now on Netflix. More in a moment on 720 WGN.